Hello and welcome to another edition of the PBT Podcast. I'm Kurt Heelan, the managing editor at Pro Basketball Top, and I am joined today by Brett Polikoff. How you doing, Brett?
Hey, what's going on?
And we've got Dominic Rittgaard from NBC Sports as well. Hey, Dom, how you doing this morning?
Good, Kurt. What's up, man?
Good. We've got a lot to talk about going around the NBA and looking at the news going on, and it's got to start right now with Chicago, where they have fired Coach Tom Thibodeau, as had been expected for a long time, but it starts to, it raises all the questions about, hey, is this the right move for them, which I kind of think it is, and, where do they go from here? And Brett, I'll start with you. Do you think it was the right move?
I think the situation just got to the point where it was untenable. The relationship between Thibodeau and the front office has been strained for a couple of years now. We've heard about that nonstop. You saw the way the organization threw him under the bus with that press release, just basically saying, to summarize, basically saying, look, he can't play well with others, right? He just shuts us out. He doesn't communicate with us. He doesn't, take our ideas into consideration. It's his way or the highway. And so that was the primary reason more than anything else. But look, they did say, hey, if we were playing for the championship right now, we wouldn't be having this conversation. I picked the Bulls to come out of the East. I thought they had enough to get there, but we clearly saw that that wasn't the case, at least under Thibodeau. And we saw the way that they got rolled in that last game, against the Cavaliers. Maybe they quit on their coach. Maybe they just realized that, it wasn't going to happen. So I think it was time to part ways. And look, obviously Fred Hoiberg is the guy that the Chicago front office has had from the beginning as Thibodeau's replacement. And the fact that we have two first-time NBA head coaches in the finals right now, hard to argue with them choosing a first-timer to replace Thibodeau.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I think to start with, does Hoiberg want the job? This is a guy who is, I think he'll make an NBA jump at some point, but he is the mayor of Ames, Iowa. He grew up in Ames, Iowa. He played at Iowa State. He owns that, that city and that program right now. He's in a very comfortable spot. And by the way, he's a guy who, within the last 6 months, had heart procedures. This is a guy who's had some real physical issues. Is deep dish pizza and more stress what he wants in his life right now, or is he gonna, say, hey, I'm going to wait. He's got connections in Minnesota as well. That's where he worked in the front office after he played in the NBA. He could sit this out for a year or two and then replace Flip Saunders and take over a team that'll have, Andrew Wiggins plus, whoever they take as the number one pick this year. It could be a very tempting situation. So it'll be interesting to see if he takes the gig. But back to the Bulls, Dom, it's a situation, isn't it, where I think it's got to be a little bit on both sides. In Thibodeau's case, he's not that easy to get along with, but I don't think they really did him a ton of favors either.
Yeah, I agree. And like we were talking about, no one's really shocked that he was fired because, the leaks about the tension between the two camps is it's been pretty rampant lately. I just think it's kind of funny, there was these rumors floating around that, the Bulls front office was being kind of vindictive, and there was even a rumor that they were going to wait until all the coaching vacancies were filled and then fire him, almost as their last kind of grandstand against them. And, the media kind of got to the point where they're like, wow, that's just mean. If you want to fire him, just fire him. So then they went complete scorched earth, and then it was like, whoa, that was a bit excessive. It's kind of funny how that flipped rather quickly. But to your point, Kurt, it just got, the divorce was bound to happen. I just think that now that there's some finality to it, now it's kind of, now we're kind of reversing track and thinking Thibs was obviously had a great track record as a coach. Why did this move have to happen? And it just seems like, we've seen this before, just egos clash, and they put it before success sometimes. And, I feel like that is part of the case with the Bulls front office firing Thibs.
Yeah, look, this is a front office that couldn't get along with Vinny Del Negro, who is, by the way, I dealt with him out in Los Angeles. He is one of the more mellow people you'll kind of ever run into. Whatever you think of his coaching acumen, he's not like this intense, high-strung guy, yet, he was choking, with Paxton. It's it's a kind of, you know, at some point I think it starts to fall back on them. Brett, the question is on one hand it looks like a tempting job. Is it like the best job open, or are there flaws with there?
No, it's the best spot open, no matter what is going on with the front office, no matter how much interference they're trying to give. You know, I've said this with a bunch of coaching firings over the last few seasons. It doesn't matter how good you are at your job. If your bosses hate working with you, you're not going to last long. That's just the reality of any job. That's my job. You know, Kurt, if you start to hate me, I'm not going to be around very much. This is the way it is. It doesn't matter. Nothing else matters. So, short of winning a championship, those issues are going to be real. That's why Mark Jackson was out in Golden State despite a 51-win season, although we saw that Steve Kerr and Alvin Gentry have done a great job in taking the Warriors, obviously, to a next level. George Karl in Denver, after one of their best seasons ever, you know, he wasn't listening to management in terms of the players that they wanted him to play, so he was out. Lionel Hollins with the Grizzlies, same thing, took him all the way to the Western Conference Finals. And he was out because he couldn't get along with the front office, was opposed to listening to their suggestions regarding advanced analytics. So that's the reality of life in the NBA. So Thibodeau will land on his feet eventually. He's a great coach. I kind of like, Kurt, you wrote this in your three coaches who could replace Thibodeau piece that went up this morning. I kind of like Alvin Gentry for the Chicago opening because of the reasons you said. He's essentially the polar opposite of Thibodeau. He's a veteran's coach, he's a player's coach, much more relaxed and much more offensively oriented. So if they're really looking for a departure from Thibodeau, you could get a veteran guy like Gentry to run the show, and I think you'd see some immediate improvement in how far the Bulls were able to get in the postseason.
Yeah, Dom, who do you like to bring in there? Because I'm kind of with him. Look, Hoiberg is the guy. Look, no, there's no denying this is the guy they want. As an NBA guy, to me, he's a bit of an unknown. I know GMs think he's ready, but who would you bring in?
Well, to Brett's point, I think when he said that, you know, if you can't get along with your bosses, like, it doesn't matter how good you are. And, you know, bringing up the Mark Jackson was the exact similarity that I was thinking of. It's just you need someone there that will at least acquiesce to certain requests. And I think immediately the fact that they want Fred Hoiberg and his name has been out there for almost at the beginning. I feel like I heard when the tension started building, like I heard his name immediately. So clearly I think that's someone that they would that at least feel like would acquiesce to what they would want and what they want to see changed. So immediately you think, okay, if that's who the front office has already tabbed, they already believe that he can get the job done. So that immediately makes me think that they're gonna at least give him the first shot. I also heard Michael Wilbon from ESPN, you know, he's noted as a kind of a big Chicago voice in the media. He mentioned Tyronn Lue from Chicago, or excuse me, from Cleveland. And at first I was kind of like, you know, it kind of rubbed me the wrong way. You know, he doesn't have a lot of even like head assistant experience. I believe this is his first or second year. I know he was under Doc for a long time. Or his first or second year as one of like the head assistants of a team. But, you know, we've seen the first year coaches have a lot of success. He was a former player. And I feel like I haven't heard anything about him being untenable or hard to get along with. So I think that was actually a pretty good suggestion.
You know, actually, I will tell you that players love Lou. Absolutely love Tyronn Lue. And I, as an easy example, and this is something I was doing, and I do once a week for NBC, I take over the NBC Sports Twitter account and do the Twitter chat, and I had written about a couple of weeks ago, somebody asked, you know, if Blatt's out, who's in? And first off, I don't think Blatt's going anywhere, especially now that they're in the finals, but in Cleveland, but I'm like, if he's out, look at Tyronn Lue, you know, the players love him, and to our Twitter chat, I got replied to by Jared Dudley, who's been making his own waves this week, but Jared Dudley actually jumped into the Twitter chat and said, yeah, if he doesn't look for him to get a job somewhere this year, we do love him. Like, this is a guy really well-respected, and he's going to get a shot somewhere within the next couple years. So it'd be an interesting match. Look, Adrian Griffin is the third name you hear a lot, who is the lead assistant under Thibodeau in Chicago, and he's better liked by the players, better liked by, I should say, and I think that that's one of the things we haven't discussed. Brett, that's one of the things that they now the Bulls are throwing him under the bus. Oh, I don't want the players didn't like Thibodeau thing, but I've been told that's true from another source who had said they loved him the first year, but by year three, as the injuries piled up and the long practices never stopped and the long shoot-arounds and everything else that's the grind of working with Thibodeau, the players turned on him a little bit. They were ready for the move.
Well, first of all, I'm not going to let you guys bring up Tyronn Lue without talking about the highlight of his career, which is being stepped over by Allen Iverson in 2001. There's just no way that doesn't go unsaid.
Yeah. He actually played, so he defended him fairly well in that series, all things considered.
Come on.
Agreed, Brent.
But that makes it even more ironic that he's so well-respected by the players when that's really what he's known for. But, no, I mean, Lou would get the job in Cleveland if something were to happen to Blatt. It's not going to. Cavs owner Dane Gilbert is on the record publicly saying it wasn't going to happen whether they made the finals or not, which I don't necessarily believe. I believe that there would have been an evaluation process done. And the other thing with Lou in Cleveland, if it were to ever happen, LeBron James has a huge say in that Cleveland locker room and on the sideline. They need a guy there that will, listen to LeBron and that will let LeBron sort of do his thing and not be afraid or overshadowed or worried about being stepped on. So whether that's Lou, I mean, Blatt has obviously, struck that balance this season. You know, that's fine. You know, as far as the players in Chicago, I think there's something to that. You know, Joakim Noah has that quote this season where he was asked about Thibodeau and motivating, and he's like, "You think I need a coach for me to play as hard as I can?" So that was a little bit telling right there. Obviously, the heavy minutes that all those guys play. I mean, Jimmy Butler had a fantastic season this year, but he's still playing, 46 minutes a game. And over time, that's just not a recipe for success. You have to find a way to give your star players a little bit of balance. So, it's true. Maybe his style did great on the players in Chicago a little bit, but, either way, he's out now. They're going to have to look to go in a different direction from a personality standpoint. I don't really know anything about Hoiberg in terms of his coaching style. I do know Gentry fairly well from covering him in Phoenix for all those years that he was a head coach there. And he's a great coach, very player-friendly, veterans coach guy. He would be an excellent choice for Chicago or really any other opening that where they're looking for offense and they're looking for a guy that has the respect of his players.
Okay. Next question is just like, how good is that Chicago roster, or is in the wake of Thibodeau? I mean, how much Joakim Noah is left? How much Derrick Rose is left? How good is this team?
Hey, Kurt, can I get to the minutes thing for another quick second?
Oh, yeah, no,
because
go for it.
Because a lot of people say, yeah, it's not just that, but I watched a lot of Bulls games this year because we've been streaming them via Live Extra, and it's real. Like, that's not just a media creation. I watched a lot of those games. They'd be down 25 in the fourth, up 25 in the fourth, and Jimmy Butler still logging in the 40s every night. When Derrick Rose was hurt, even Aaron Brooks would play like 36, 38 minutes, and it's just like, Thibs, come on, man. It was almost to the point where I thought he was doing it on purpose. Like, almost as almost as a defiant, almost like you could see him looking at the Bulls brass in the face and saying, "No, I'm not taking them out." It got to the point where it got ridiculous. But to your question, yeah, there are a lot of questions or more questions with this roster than I think a lot of people want to let on. And I think it starts with the first person you mentioned, Joakim Noah, where he was first team All NBA what, 2 seasons ago.
Yeah.
And he looked like he couldn't even run in the series against the Cavs. He was getting outworked on the boards by Mozgov and Thompson. Couldn't give you anything offensively. He couldn't finish at the rim, and I didn't know if it was lift. I don't know if he didn't feel comfortable, but he was almost a negative working on that side of the ball. So I think it kind of starts with him, and then it trickles down to, do you think Derrick Rose can give you what, more than 65 games? If you're just resting him, not even if he gets hurt, and it goes down the line with, so what do you do with your wing depth? Do you start giving Doug McDermott minutes? Do you actually start playing Tony Snell some? Do you start playing Nikola? What happens with Taj Gibson? Does Nikola Mirotic slide into that kind of third big with, because you assume obviously Noah and Power are going to come back? So there are a lot of questions, Kurt.
Yeah.
Well, I think.
Go ahead.
Look,
go ahead.
I think. Yeah, I think what you said about Noah is spot on. I mean, it got to the point in the playoffs where every time they passed him the ball, I'm like, why are you passing it to him on the offensive end of the floor? Because the defense can sag. If he throws it up, it's going to be an awful shot. So it's going to be interesting to see if we hear anything about Noah's health, if that was a factor at all. But he definitely has to do something with his offensive game and not be a complete liability out there. I think that roster is fairly stacked, especially in the Eastern Conference. I think all those guys that we've talked about, Noah, Butler, Gibson, Derrick Rose, Mirotić, that's a lot of talent on that roster. And I think the right coach will be able to sort of plug and play, find the right pieces, and find the balance during the regular season not to play the starters all those heavy minutes so that they are, in fact, healthy for the postseason.
And not only healthy for the postseason, it's the classic Popovich system of, hey, if I'm giving, you know, Danny Green or even Matt Bonner or some of these guys, you know, Matt Bonner might be the perfect example. He gives Matt Bonner minutes during the course of the season, and he gives some of these other guys minutes during the course of the season, then he actually started him in the, you know, playoffs and finals last year at Poise because of the matchups, and suddenly, you know, Matt Bonner is trusted to be thrown in, but he's earned that trust with his team. He's played in key situations over the course of the season. It's, you know, he's willing to sacrifice, in Popovich's case, like willing to sacrifice games over the course of the season.
For sure.
To really, you know, teach these guys and have them ready for the playoffs. I don't know that as many coaches will go that far, but how much can you trust Tony Snell or some of these guys if you haven't played them during the course of the season? You've got to give these guys minutes. And, like, here's an easy one. They could have used the shooting. They needed points. Their offense was struggling. Doug McDermott never gets off the bench, but they didn't trust him enough during the season. Dougie Buckets, look, he's a rookie, but the guy can shoot the rock, man. And
he is brutal defensively, though.
That's
brutal.
Kurt,
you
brought up a good point because there were stretches during the regular season where even Mirotić could barely get off the bench for like more than six, eight minutes. And everybody, like, watch Bulls fans or even just people who know basketball were watching them and just scratching their head, like, don't you need this guy to play? And I can't remember what month it was. I think it might have been January where he really carried them. You know, you could see him build his confidence, and then they started getting healthier again, and his minutes started to decline, and then you could see the confidence kind of slowly seep away from him. And it was the same thing with Tony Snell. I think it was Butler had to sit out a couple games, and you could see his confidence build, and as soon as he got healthy, it was like, okay, I'm back to 6 minutes a game, and he started getting worried about the shots he was taking because he realized if they weren't going in, he would get pulled. And that's just no way to stack the others on your team. You know what your workhorses are going to give you, but you, like you said, you need to build confidence in those other players. And I feel like Thibs just wasn't willing to kind of stick his neck out for them.
Yeah, and you know, it's like we've been saying now, this is a tempting job because of all these things. This is a team you think it can be as good or a little bit better than it was this year if you hold up the defense and you put in a slightly more modern, even vaguely more modern offense, and you know, run some of these guys out. In the East, you stand a chance of still having one of the top few seeds, and then it gets down to the playoffs, and, you know, look, I got a feeling that Cleveland is going to be better next year than this year, like this is more like the Miami situation in the sense of that they're really starting to figure it out. And by next year and a couple years after that, they'll be tough to beat. But this is, you know, the Bulls are one of the teams who would have a legitimate, you know, chance, I think. They certainly have the talent on the roster, if healthy, to make a run at them. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see who they can attract as a coach. And on the flip side of that, I mean, where do you guys think Thibodeau should land? I mean, I know for a fact that they're interested in talking to him in New Orleans, and it's not even really Dell Demps. I mean, it's the guys over his head. It's the Saints guys. It's Mickey Loomis, the Saints guys, who are like, hey, that hard-driving coach thing worked for us in football, so maybe we should try it. But do you think he's a good, you know, we'll start with Brett, do you think he's a good landing spot in New Orleans?
You know, not really. Look, he's a good coach. He'd be a fine fit, I think, anywhere. I like him as a coach. He'll probably take some lessons learned from the Chicago experience about not getting along with the front office and about maybe pushing his players a little bit too hard. I think once some time passes, he may reflect on that and realize that he has to tone it down a little bit. But look, in New Orleans, they had Monty Williams, who, by the way, him and Thibodeau are both, you know, Team USA assistant coaches. it's the same thing. You know, Monty Williams was a defensive-minded guy, you know, didn't make a lot of adjustments during the game. Was more of a practice coach, more of a put the sets in place and then kind of let his players figure things out, you know, during the regular season. But, you know, I don't see a huge difference there between Monty Williams and Tom Thibodeau. So I think, you know, while you do fine anywhere, that's not necessarily a big enough change for the Pelicans organization to blow out a guy that was there for 5 years. And the other factor in New Orleans, Dell Demps has not done a great job the last few years putting that roster together. If you go and look at all the Pelicans transactions, it's a lot of underwhelming things, a lot of moves that didn't work out, a lot of pieces that don't fit. He's not looking for a guy to come in that's going to want a lot of control and have a huge name and a huge say. He's in a little bit of a job preservation mode. So it's going to be interesting to see whether ownership makes that coaching hire decision or whether the GM does in New Orleans. But either way, Thibodeau would be a fine fit, but he's not enough of a change, in my opinion, over Monty Williams.
Despite Monty Williams' defensive credentials, that team was not good defensively, and it was kind of look, you've got to remember that not only do they have Anthony Davis, they've got Omer Asik up front. Like, that front line should have been rock solid, and it just was not. They didn't get much help on the perimeter. Some of that was injuries and personnel, but some of that was just the systems that they had in place really didn't work. So, look, they'd be better defensively with that guy, with Thibs coming in. They would be better. They would win, you know, five more games maybe, six more games, partially just because Anthony Davis is going to get better. What really makes New Orleans tempting is that was a very banged up team last year. Remember, Drew Holiday didn't play, you know, much of the season. Ryan Anderson, who's so arguably, when healthy, the best stretch four in the game, certainly one of them, missed a lot of time up until the end of the season, but by the playoffs was playing pretty well. You get him back all season. You make some defensive adjustments on that team. Anthony Davis is 22, man. He's getting better. Like, he's still on the steep part of the learning curve thing, which is frightening. That team's going to be, I think, just better by nature next year. And you're getting the right coach that gets them to defend, and suddenly that team's winning 50-plus games and looking a lot more dangerous in the West. But I'm still of the idea that Thibs would start to burn. You know, look, Anthony Davis is a guy who's shown... I don't want to say injury prone, because that's not what I'm trying to say, but he's a guy who's had nicks and bumps. He's not the thickest guy that's playing in the league. He's had nicks and bruises and kind of things that caused him to miss a game here, a couple games there over the course of the season. And the minutes thing concerns me with him. You know, I think Gentry makes more sense there. Orlando does make more sense to me for Thibodeau, but they are very committed to the hard-driving, defensive-focused Scott Skiles, apparently. Ownership loves him. And Brett, I know you are arguably the biggest Scott Skiles supporter in the league, so you're probably loving this.
Look, I think there's a reason Jeff Van Gundy's willing to come out of the broadcast booth to go back into coaching again if that New Orleans job is available. I mean, it's extremely desirable just because you have arguably a top three player in the league who, as you mentioned, is 22 years old. He's going to be under contract there for the foreseeable future. There's reports that, I don't know, maybe there was just one report, but that Thibodeau wasn't super interested in it because he felt like as soon as Davis gets the chance at free agency, he's going to bolt. But look, that's not for years to come. I mean, he's going to be a restricted free agent first,
yep.
And there's no way the Pelicans are going to let him go. I don't care what happens in the next couple of years, no matter how much of a disaster that franchise might be. And again, it's a long shot because, like you said, they'll probably just get better this season because of health and because of Davis's improvement. He's going to be under contract for the next several seasons. So that's an extremely desirable job. I think, as you mentioned, you know, the Magic are already pretty much far down that row with Scott Skiles, who is, you know, very similar to Thibodeau. So it'll be interesting. I mean, maybe he sits out a year, you know, if there's no desirable coaching positions come available. Hey, maybe Byron Scott burns out in Los Angeles. Maybe Kobe Bryant doesn't come back, and then, you know, he takes the Lakers job a year from now. It'll be interesting to see.
Can Thibodeau take a year off? Like, mentally, physically, could that guy actually take a year off? I don't know if he can.
He's getting paid for a year
$9 million says he can.
By the way, the Laker rumor was out there. First off, I'll just tell you, based out here, that rumor didn't come out of Los Angeles. I'll throw you that out. Just tell that to everybody out there. I know that. Look, Byron Scott is a placeholder coach until they figure out what kind of team they're going to be, and they were interested in Thibs a couple years ago, but they still don't know what kind of team they're going to be. And like you said, you can't. the last year of Kobe Bryant and Tom Thibodeau are just, that is the worst idea ever. All right. Well, we've talked a little bit about that. There's some other things going on, like on the court, it turns out, still in the NBA. We've gotten to the NBA final set, and next week we'll spend a whole podcast starting to break down Golden State versus Cleveland and what should be a kind of some really interesting matchups and a very entertaining NBA finals. But let's look at some of the teams that are gone in the short term, since we've got some time to break that one down, thanks to the NBA's scheduling system. We'll take a look at. Let's start in Houston. They get eliminated 4-1 after what was. I guess we'll start here. Did they overachieve, Dom? Is this a team that got farther along with 56 wins and making it to the conference finals than they should have?
I don't want to throw any shade, but I think they overachieved and I think a lot of Hoops fans would agree. I still think that just from the eye test, from watching the regular season, I still think the Clippers are a better team, and I still think the Spurs are a better team. And they had the great comeback against the Clippers. I can't take anything away from them, but I still think on just the pecking order of the Western Conference, if you just said in a vacuum, rattle off the five best teams in the West, I think people would still say Houston is 4 or 5. But to their credit, they made it to the Western Conference, albeit on the back of, you know, the runner-up for the MVP. I think they overachieved, but I also think they deserve a lot of credit. I think Kevin McHale deserves a lot of credit, and I think Daryl Morey deserves a lot of credit for, you know, mid-season pivoting. A lot like with the Cavaliers, a lot of big contributors for that team weren't even on their roster at the beginning of the season. Like Josh Smith just fell into their lap, and he was a huge reason why they made it that far. The same thing with a guy like Corey Brewer. So I think they overachieved, but I also think they deserve a lot of credit.
Brett, do you bring Josh Smith back?
Yeah, depending on the finances and all that stuff. You know, obviously when you make it to the conference finals, there's a lot going right on that team. But as Dom mentioned, a lot of that is due to James Harden just being ridiculous, unstoppable for most of the season. I mean, he had an incredible year. He was my choice for MVP just for what he did for that Rockets team. When you look at the roster, there's not anybody else on that team capable of dropping 30 points in a game. So the defense is focused on him every single night. He made more free throws during the regular season than the person who was second on that list even attempted. His ability to draw fouls and get to the rim is unmatched, really, in the league. That being said, he needs some help. They need another guy on the offensive end of the floor to make the leap. I do think that they overachieved a bit. I would agree that, you know, if you look top to bottom, a lot of people would have the Spurs maybe as being a better team. Clippers, I don't know, because their bench is just so brutal. I mean, once you get past Jamal Crawford, you're looking at Austin Rivers. I mean, that's the reality of the depth on that Clippers squad, despite how prolific their starting unit has been. Definitely the Rockets overachieved. They're going to need to add some pieces, but they did a fantastic job this season, largely due to, you know, the brilliance of James Harden.
First off, Dwight Howard would like you to know that he can drop 30 points, and he is a champion, no matter what you all say.
I really want to say what he's the champion of, but it's a family-friendly podcast, so we're just going to leave it there.
Skittle eating, he'd be right up there. He'd be one of the better Skittle eaters.
Sure.
You know, it's funny. I said yesterday, I'm not comfortable with the word overachieved because Harden played so well, because this was, you know, this is not a bad team. I mean, this is a really good team that defended pretty well all season. I'm just not sure, if you look at them going into next season, that they can replicate 56 wins or get back to this spot. Like you said, I'm with you. Look, if the Clippers have any depth at all, they're here. Like, they're playing Golden. I don't know, but they're still playing. But they at least get on to Golden State. That they had to go to Austin Rivers. That they had depth they couldn't trust and wore down their starters to the point that those guys, you know, look. Great shooting comeback by Houston in Game 6. That amazing comeback where, part of it was Josh Smith and Corey Brewer and guys just knocking down shots they wouldn't normally knock down on a consistent basis. But part of it was the Clippers were too tired to defend anymore. They were too tired to stop that run physically. I don't know, you bring back Houston in a similar form, And I think they win 52-53 games because the West, look, the West is going to be better, or probably be better next year. You're not going to see a ton of drop-off from some teams. You're going to see teams who, like New Orleans that we were discussing, who should be better. Oklahoma City is going to be healthy. Teams like Sacramento will probably be better. I mean, the West...
not going to let you say Sacramento is going to be better ever.
George Karl, yeah, we'll see what happens there. I don't think they're making the playoffs. But I just don't think that they can replicate it. And then, like you said, you get to the playoffs, and I think things really broke for them about as well as they could break to get there, and I don't know that you can count on that another season. So,
and it's easy to forget, like, we were talking about the Clippers fatigue, and they were up 19. Like they,
yeah,
you know, it kind of flies in the face of conventional, like, talking about sports. You never say someone should have won or any of that stuff. The Clippers should have won that game. Like that I watched all 48 minutes of that game, and like my jaw hit the floor when they ended up losing by like 12. They ended up losing by double. Like, fatigue aside, I feel like it's valid. Like they definitely were tired, especially Blake Griffin. Like you could just see it on the guy's face, like he wore down. But I mean, they should have won that series.
That one game is an aberration. Obviously, you know, that was an insane comeback. Can't blame only fatigue. There's a lot of factors that went into it. You know, mentally, you saw on the Clippers' faces. You know, once the Rockets made that comeback, you know, guys were passing up open shots, you know, and then the guys late in the shot clock had to force things. But I think the fatigue is real. You look throughout the playoffs, you look at Blake Griffin sort of disappearing in fourth quarters of games. He plays a very physical style of basketball, and these guys are in amazing shape. They're incredible athletes, but he does have to play too many minutes. The starters on the Clippers have to play too many minutes because there's no depth. So if they can find a way to add depth, and it's going to be almost impossible. You look at the salary cap situation. You look at the guys that they have currently under contract. It's going to be very difficult to add key players. But I think that's a real factor in terms of putting a ceiling on how far the Clippers can go the way the roster is currently constructed.
Oh, for sure. But even as constructed, would you guys, after watching the regular season and watching that seven-game series, do you think that the Clippers as a team were better than the Rockets as a team, or is that just me?
No, the Clippers were better. And I will say this, to me, the Clippers were the better team. If they play that series 10 times, the Clippers win it 7 or 8.
Yeah, doesn't always mean you win the series, but I just felt like they were a better team.
Yeah.
Even with all their trouble with depth.
Yeah, I will say, and I will give the Rockets props for this. You know, I went to the games in L.A. in that series. I was in the look. After game four, when they got, you know, they're down 3-1, it was kind of a crushing loss. They looked broken. To me, Houston looked done. And that they came out in game five and won it, you know, it was to their credit. Now, part of that is I'm not sure that I think the Clippers think, hey, we got a few games, we're going to coast. I don't think that was their best effort. But to Houston's credit, they did not roll over when I've seen that look in the eyes of other playoff teams, and most of the time they just come out and roll over and accept what's coming.
For sure.
And Houston didn't. So kudos to them for fighting through this. But what kind of moves do you think they need to make in the offseason? You know, to me, it needs to start with they've got to find and Daryl Morey, look, you can argue that this team would be hard to maneuver, but there are a lot of pieces there that they can move, that they could do things with. Do you bring back Josh Smith? And to me, you've got to find another guy who can create shots besides James Harden. They need another ball-handling, shot-creating guy.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's the whole thing, man. Again, there's nobody capable on that team of really going off offensively besides Harden. You thought the defense is focused on him this season. Just wait till next year. I mean, it's going to be even worse. You know, Corey Brewer was big for this team, especially in the playoffs. He's an unrestricted free agent. Josh Smith, unrestricted free agent. So, you know, they got some decisions to make. They're going to get, you know, Patrick Beverley back, although, you know, he's a restricted free agent. So how much money do you spend on him once he's healthy? He's obviously an excellent defender on that team. So it's going to be interesting to see. You know, they got guys like Trevor Ariza locked up for several seasons, and obviously Dwight and James Harden aren't going anywhere. But there is, you know, some maneuvering that needs to be done. You know, they'll get Monta Yunus back, you know, that's another big man that could have helped with their depth issues. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see, but I think, you know, some support offensively for James Harden has to be the priority.
Dom, do you go big game hunting if you're Daryl Morey? I don't know that he doesn't ever go big game hunting, but do you?
I think you can. I mean, I think that, you know, when you – I feel like for me, one of the things I look at when I try to pinpoint a championship team is do you have a hierarchy of your top three guys? Do you feel comfortable with your top guy being – the best player on a championship team, which I think personally for me, Harden kind of put that to bed. I know he had a horrible last game, but I feel like he put that to bed for me. And then you have the 2-3 spots. I feel comfortable that Dwight can be the second or third best player on a championship team. But then when you get to that third spot, I don't think that way about Trevor Ariza. I don't think that way about Josh Smith or Monta Yunus, Patrick Beverley. I think you can still win with how they built, trying to have their two core pieces and then kind of fill the rows below that with above average NBA talent. But I think you have to at least try and get that third piece where you can say, okay, we've got our 1-2-3. Now let's fill from the bottom up.
Well, Adrian Wojnarowski, our friend from Yahoo Sports, threw Kevin Love's name into the mix as a guy. Remember, he played for Kevin McHale in Minnesota. To me, like, look, on paper, that'd be a really interesting fit. Your stretch four, somebody who can space the floor, somebody who can get you points inside in a way Dwight may not be always be able to physically. But I will also add, I'm of the impression Love will not leave Cleveland, just because of image issues. It would look bad for him if he goes. But that would be an interesting fit. That's one out there. LaMarcus Aldridge, you know, grew up in Texas, in Dallas, but. Want, you know, if he goes, I think he comes back to one of the Texas. If he leaves Portland, don't you guys think he goes to one of the Texas teams?
Well, let me just say this on Kevin Love. I think there is a scenario where we could see him leave Cleveland after this season. Let's say the Cavaliers were to win the championship this year, and they that would mean that they did so without Kevin Love after the first round of the playoffs. So he could say, hey, guys, I had a great time in Cleveland. Love playing there, love LeBron James, you know, love the situation, love the city, but I want to go somewhere where I'm needed. And obviously the Cavaliers don't need me. They won a championship without me. That could be his out, to save the image, to save everything, to get a max deal, you know, once again being the guy who's a focal point of the offense. We know in his reduced role he wasn't as happy this year. I mean, he's fine. You know, winning cures a lot. His first time he ever made it to the playoffs, he put up all those video game numbers in Minnesota, and they never made the postseason. So he obviously liked the taste of the playoffs, but I really think, and it's a big if, right? I mean, the Warriors are almost, you know, 2-1 favorites or more to win the title. But if the Cavaliers were to find a way to get it done, I think that's a scenario where we could see Kevin Love just say, hey, I want to go somewhere where I'm needed, where I can actually be the focal point and help a team get to the championship. As much fun as Cleveland was, they obviously didn't need me.
Well, I mean, look, Kevin Love's name is always – the Lakers have always been on the top of the list if you talk to people. If that's where he's going to go. But, Dom, you know, if he wants to be the man, does he go to Houston?
Being the man, I don't think you would go to Houston only because they already have one in James Harden. But I think it's less about that, and because even if he went to L.A. right away, he wouldn't be the man because obviously that's a Kobe Bryant town. But it's about – kind of feeling that appreciation again that I'm wanted and my skills will be highlighted, because he floated in and out of the Cavs kind of priority list a lot. You know, they have their 1-2 and he was way third in that pecking order. And I think to Brett's point about them winning without him, one of the highlight players of filling in his role has been Tristan Thompson, who, you know, I think it was Van Gundy say he could get the max this offseason. And at first I was like, whoa, that's insane. And I still don't think I personally wouldn't pay him the max, but just watching how he's been playing, I could see teams becoming infatuated with him. And I could see, you know, LeBron's agent is his agent, and I could totally see if they win a championship, LeBron say, you know, we're not sure about if Kev wants to stay, and I want you to take care of my guy. So the funds could be allocated differently to the point where he not only would he be higher on the pecking order in Houston, but they could potentially pay him more.
Yeah, I guess Tristan Thompson's free agency, which we can get into down the line some days, is an interesting math exercise because I think he's not going to get. I don't know that he gets a max, but I mean, if you give him $14 million a year, with the way the salaries, you know, the salary cap's about to jump, is that a bad deal? Like for what he brings?
Did you see how much money Rich Paul was able to get for Eric Bledsoe during that restricted free agency nonsense? Tristan Thompson's getting the max if LeBron James has his way. You know, the salary cap's going to spike in the next couple of years. There's going to be enough room. He's getting the max. You know, book it.
But getting back to Houston, it's really going to be an interesting offseason. To me, you know Daryl Morey is going to make moves. Like, if nothing else, they will be active. They will probably do some things that surprise us. And, look, he's been big game hunting, trying to land another big name. He did last, you know.
Tried to get Bosch.
Yeah, I would say, how close were they to having Chris Bosch? If Pat Riley doesn't come up with a max offer and say you're going to be our focal point, Chris Bosch is there, and we're possibly having a very different conversation right now about the Rockets. So I expect him to go big game hunting again, which brings us to a different team, the Atlanta Hawks, who were also eliminated by the Cleveland Cavaliers. They are not going to go big game hunting this summer, but they have a really interesting offseason. I guess we'll start there. I'm of the impression, and I don't – look, it's great if you're Cleveland or Houston. It's great if you're the Cavaliers and LeBron James falls in your lap. I don't think this was some brilliant recruiting job. LeBron James falls in your lap. He's able to make sure that you get Kevin Love there, and you've already got Kyrie Irving, and you can do all these big star things. If you're Atlanta, that's not happening. The way you've built this team where you lay out the system and then get players who fit the system is the only way that you're going to make this thing work. So, to me, that's how they have to build again this summer. They could use some pieces. They've got to keep some guys, but they have to keep, they have to keep this kind of system because superstars are not just going to fall into their lap.
Look, with Atlanta, they have some decisions to make this offseason. Paul Millsap, unrestricted free agent. He's going to command a deal, you know, very close to the max. Does Atlanta want to lock him up for that long? Are they into it? Damari Carroll, unrestricted free agent. He's going to command a ton of money on the open market. Is Atlanta going to want to step up and match it? You know what the Hawks have to do is they have to decide, is the team that won 40 of its first 48 games real, and is it capable of sustaining that through the rest of the regular season and into the playoffs, or is it the one that finished the regular season 20-14 and lost two games in the first round to a terrible Brooklyn Nets team? Now, granted, depth is a little bit of a part of that. They lost Thabo Sefolosha with a broken leg and that, you know, horrific police incident, you know, that happened before the playoffs, which I still can't believe that story isn't getting a lot more play. I mean, we have an NBA player taking out of the playoffs from the top-seeded team in the East by, you know, an incident with police. I mean, that's just crazy. Yeah. But setting that aside, you know, what's next for the Hawks team? So does the front office believe that they can compete, once again make it back to the Eastern Conference Finals and be better than the Cavaliers by locking up Millsap and Damari Carroll on huge money deals, or do they let one of those guys go and go in a different direction and try to lure somebody else on the free agent market? It's going to be very interesting to see which way they go.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the problem is that they can lure other guys, but I don't, you know, they're not landing one of the biggest names, so who do they get that fits the system? To me, look, Carroll's going to be harder to keep. There's going to be a lot of interest. That's a guy who can fit in just about anybody's system, but they can't let Millsap go. I mean, to me, he's so central to what they do in terms of his ability to knock down the three or score inside and, you know, his size. He's a guy who fits what they want to do perfectly, and I don't think they can afford to let him go. Dom?
Yeah, I agree. I think that as far as the priority list for, you know, I'm looking at their unrestricted free agents right now, and there's really only two that stand out, which is Millsap and Carroll, but they're two huge – there would be two huge gaps if they obviously can't let both of them walk. And you said, you know, 3-and-D guys like Damari Carroll kind of became – for a while, he was their scoring leader in the postseason. Like, he really started playing well before he got hurt. I think he earned himself a lot of money, not just with his regular season play, but with his postseason play. But Paul Millsap and Al Horford worked in great unison together when they were both fully healthy, regular season and postseason. You know, Millsap's play dropped off a little bit because of the shoulder, but I think having that front court tandem kind of work so well in unison makes him a higher priority. And I think it wouldn't shock me if they pony up a max deal for him. So you talk about, you know, they're not going to big game hunt, but when you commit a max salary or close to it to one of your guys, it's almost the same thing. You're not bringing them from the outside. You're committing from the inside, but you're still allocating a ton of your cap space to that one player.
That's actually a very valid point. I guess the question that floats out of this is, let's say they keep both of them. Let's say they add maybe some depth or something, they make some moves around the edges, but they keep the core together. Can they replicate this? Can they be a 60-win team again or in that ballpark and make it to the conference finals again?
Yeah, I don't necessarily think so. I mean, it's the Eastern Conference, so anything is possible. But I think, look, they had the element of surprise at the beginning of the season. Nobody thought that they would execute that well as consistently as they did. And they just ran up on teams that weren't expecting that level, of fluid offense. So I think now that sort of we all know what to expect from this Hawks team. I think there's a lot of film on them now that other teams can look at to try to slow them down. And, it's going to be difficult for them to get to 60 wins again. If they're healthy, that's a good team. It's a lot of guys. What we saw in the playoffs, man, they're just not as dominant as the record would make them out to be.
Well, I think you mentioned something really quickly that's important there. This team was largely healthy over the course of the season. They got banged up in the playoffs. Millsap's probably going to have shoulder surgery this summer. Carroll was dragging one leg around, and as you mentioned, Thabo Sofolosha made the mistake of running into the New York Police Department. But
Horford's pinky, right?
Exactly. But over the course of the season, this was a largely healthy team, and I'm not rooting for anything, but statistically, odds are going to say that you don't get that a couple years in a row, generally. Like, if things catch up with you, and I think that that's what makes it hard to picture them doing this again, is, A, them getting this kind of seed. I mean, they were, if you use the Pythagorean, if you use the, for those of you at home, you based what their record should be based on point differential, they're a 55-win team, not a 60-win team, which is still really good, but it's a different, it's five games less, and it makes you think maybe a little bit differently about them. If they're a 55-win team who loses a game or two from that number and is let's say they win 53, 54 games, maybe is their seeding the same, especially in a year where, Cleveland might be better, there's other teams who could be rising up in the East possibly, depending on, who goes where this summer. I think, like you're saying, it's still the East, so there's still a chance, but I've got a feeling that come the playoffs next year, it's going to be, they're not going to quite have the same seed, and it's going to be a much rougher road for them to get back to the conference finals than it was this year, where the conference was kind of a mess by the playoffs.
Can I pose two questions to both of you guys?
Yeah.
One, and it's a popular one that was floated around, and it's obviously a hypothetical, but, a lot of people were saying if John Wall doesn't break his wrist, and I think it was game one, the Wizards, they feel strongly that the Wizards would have won that series. And I watched the Wizards, their whole playoff run and the Hawks, and I thought they were playing at a much higher level than the Hawks were. And I would, I don't like subscribing to hypotheticals, but that's one that I kind of I find myself leaning towards, at least as a Hoops fan, just being a little upset. Like, man, it would have been awesome to see a healthy John Wall, because I think they would have won that series. So I guess that's the first question. And the second question is, and you brought it up, they're in the East, but do you guys – and this is as much as a question, I don't even necessarily have an answer. I just generally kind of want some insight. Do you feel like the East will get better? Because I feel like we've had this conversation about how weak the conference is for a while now. It's been top heavy the last couple seasons. It was the Heat and Pacers, and now this year it was more the for a long stretch it was the Cavs and Hawks. And like I said, the Wizards started to play better, but for a lot of the regular season it was the Cavs and Hawks. Will the East find a way to kind of ascend so it's not just, oh, it's the East, you'll always have a shot?
I'll take a shot at those. First off, I think the East will get better eventually. Fortunately, they have the top two picks in the draft. Oh, wait, no, those are going to the West, too. Eventually things will. I think the East will be better if you just think about it again next year. You mentioned the Pacers. We'll see what happens with Roy Hibbert, but they get Paul George back. Like, you know, yeah. Suddenly that team looks far better. You know, I think that there's going to be a rougher road for getting out of the East, that there'll be a little more depth in the conference next year, and eventually that'll build. I think the pendulum ultimately swings, but it just may take time. And, by the way, I completely subscribe to the theory. I had picked the Wizards. I think they would have won that series if Wall is completely healthy. And that would have been a more interesting matchup against the Cavs than obviously the sweep that we saw.
For sure.
But, you know, again, it's coulda, shoulda, woulda.
Well, and as far as, you know, of course the East will get better at some point. It's just a question of when.
Yeah.
You know, Larry Bird recently said, look at when I was playing in the 80s. You know, Magic Johnson had a cakewalk to the finals every year, and I was banging my head against the wall every single night. So it was different back then. It'll be different at some point in the future, especially with the East being such garbage that they're getting all the number one picks. You know, not all of them, obviously. Minnesota has it this year, but you know what I mean. They're always at the top of the draft year after year, especially with the Sixers doing what they've been doing. So, you know, that will happen at some point, regardless of if and when that happens. You know, this is a whole other subject that, you know, we're running out of time here, so we'll get to it another time. But, you know, the league has to look at the playoff format and get rid of this conference nonsense. You want the best matchups in the playoffs, and, you know, the conference thing is obviously making that difficult.
I don't know that they'll ever go there with the conferences. I'm hoping that they do something with the division winners after this year and how that ended up, you know, ended up matching.
That's minor, though.
Yeah, the matching the spot. It tilted
the balance of power in the West. I felt like it had a huge impact on the West.
Yeah, I mean, you end up with Clippers Spurs because of it.
Yeah.
You know, and it would have changed that dynamic. By the way, Larry Bird's comments. Doug Moe's Denver Nuggets would like to dispute that. that team put up a lot of points. Sure, they didn't play any defense. It's going to swing that way. It's going to be an interesting offseason in Atlanta, no doubt, though. Like you said, they've got two free agents out there that, and especially with somebody like Carroll, who, look, you know, Zach Lowe wrote this not that long ago. Everybody wants to find their own Damari Carroll now. Like, they picked that guy up off a scrap heap for $3 million, and he was key for them, and everybody's like, hey, who's the next Damari Carroll? Somebody's going to say, forget the next Damari Carroll. We want this one. Like,
yeah.
You know. Dom, somebody's going to come after big after him, and that's just going to make it—it's going to make it hard for them to build. And the one other thing not discussed in this whole Atlanta rebuilding, which direction do they go situation? We've got it. They've got a new owner coming through the door. That team is for sale. There's a deal being worked out. How is that going to change what will new ownership want to spend? Will they want to change things? Will they want to change? I can't imagine they're going to change coaches at this point. Budenholzer's pretty set. And they've got a system there, but do they bring in their own GM, and how does that change everything? So that's a huge variable that is just completely unpredictable. Well, that was a fun look around the league at the news going on, and what's going to be, just like I said, a really interesting summer. I want to thank everybody for listening out there. We'll be back at the start of next week to discuss the NBA Finals. And I want to thank everybody for participating here. Brett, thanks for doing this. And throw everybody your Twitter handle so they can find you.
I'm at Brett EP on Twitter.
And Dom, yours is?
At DL Riddy on Twitter.
All right. Thanks again, everybody, for doing this. Both of you for doing this. Again, check us out next week. We will break down the finals in detail. There's a couple of good players in that series, guys. There's a couple of pretty good guys.
You're right.
But it's actually, I think, like I said, we'll break it down next week. That is a finals with some fascinating matchups that could make this a little more interesting series than some people think. So thanks for everybody for listening, and we will talk to you on the PBT podcast next week.